This episode is brought to you by VPP Simplified. Now you can get element by element tracking and guidance for your VPP journey. Every aspect of the VPP requirements in one easy-to-use interactive spreadsheet. It explains every sub-element in detail, contains an easy-to-read stoplight so you can track current status for each sub-element. It provides you with a three-step verification for completion of each sub-element. There's even a notes section for you to compile language that will eventually be used for your VPP application. It even comes complete with graphs to show current state and track your progress moving forward. Look, achieving VPP star status can be tough, but understanding what it takes to get there can be simplified. This VPP gap tool will help you do that. Go to vppsimplified.com for more information.
Welcome to the Safety Pro Podcast, where we help you manage workplace safety one episode at a time. And now, your very own safety pro, Blaine J. Hoffman.
Welcome back. Another episode of the Safety Pro Podcast. Today, we're talking about contractor safety. The reason why I wanted to tackle this topic is because more and more companies are using contractors or even temporary workers, temporary employees, to perform work. And this could be anything from maintenance, construction, security, even temporary workers in the case of production-related tasks, projects that are, you know, short-term, and they don't really want to staff up and hire for these positions because that project or work is going to go away. You know, it's easy to sort of hire temporary work. The problem is it's also easy to pass off safety responsibility for contractors to somebody else, you know, like the contractor. So your company doesn't pay those contract workers. They're paid by the contractor, right? And you don't provide the workers' comp premiums or have to carry the burden for those workers. You don't have to give them any benefits and things like that. So when it comes to workplace safety, we want to make sure that we do the right thing there too. And by the right thing, I mean, we're going to start with what the regulations require and work from there. Before we jump into that topic, let's pause, take a moment to talk about MightyLine floor tape. Now, MightyLine knows how important safety is to your organization, and the breadth of the MightyLine product line covers everything you need to implement a 5S system for increased productivity at your facility and for the safety of your workers. MightyLine floor signs are a great product to regulate workplace traffic. Now the signs, they're customizable to fit exactly what your company needs. You can even customize them with your own high-res logos. And don't forget about their floor marking tape either. Their tape is 7 times thicker than the average floor tape. Their patented technology makes it more durable than other floor tapes, and the beveled edges increases durability for forklift traffic. The peel and stick adhesive removes easily and is all made right here in the USA. Go to MightyLineTape.com/podcast to get a free sample sent right to you. Again, MightyLineTape.com/podcast. All right, so let's get back to contractor safety. Keep in mind, this applies to all companies that would use contractors to perform, you know, a service that may or may not include construction work. So we're going to use the word contractor as a generic term, right? So let's define that. You have two categories. You have a contractor, which in the traditional sense of the term, that is somebody you hire, a business or a person to construct a building, to do some renovation, to do, you know, some repairs, things like that, and they go away. So construction contractor basically is the first thing that comes to people's mind when you hear the term contractor. But the term has another meaning, and that is anybody who is paid to perform a service that may or may not include construction work. It could be a contractor hired to do project management. It could be a consultant. Over a decade in corporate consulting, I was considered a contractor. I called myself a consultant. But once I was hired and under a contract, I was a contractor. So that makes sense, right? I want to talk about those that you hire to come in and perform a myriad of tasks, different types of work, including consulting, project management, IT work, things like that, folks that would be coming into your facility, commingling with your workers. And yeah, it could include construction work as well, minor repairs or maintenance. But I'm talking about things that you would normally hire somebody internally to do, but you've decided to hire it out under contract. Let's go over the definition for this discussion one more time. A contractor or a subcontractor is a person who agrees to perform any part of the labor or material requirements of a contract. So let's get right into some areas of safety that would impact your business, possibly, if you employ contractors. One big one in the industry that we hear a lot, and you may have heard this, is called the multi-employer citation policy. And I want to dive into that before we get on to some generic, you know, basic safety and health topics, because this is important to understand as an employer. Under the multi-employer worksite policy, citations could be issued to employers using temporary employees. This policy states that on multi-employer worksites, in all industry sectors, by the way, more than one employer may be citable, if you will, for a hazardous condition that violates an OSHA standard. There is a two-step process that must be followed to determine whether more than one employer is to be cited. So we're going to talk about that so that you understand how to better protect yourself when you have contractors at your facilities or on your sites. Step one, this is the first step. You have to determine whether or not the employer is a creating, exposing, correcting, or controlling employer. I'm going to go into the definitions of each type of employer. Once you determine the role of the employer, then you move on to the second step to determine if a citation is appropriate. Keep in mind, only exposing employers can be cited for general duty clause violations under this policy. So the second step is if you fall into one of those categories, again, I'll define those here in a moment, then it has obligations with respect to OSHA requirements. And that's where OSHA is going to make sure they determine which type of employer you are if you fall into one of those four categories. Depending upon which category you fall into, that's going to drive the type of citation you may receive. The type of citation you receive, of course, is a direct result of the responsibilities you would have under the regulations. So the extent of the actions required of the employers, it varies based on which category applies, and the extent that the measures that a controlling employer must take to satisfy its duty to exercise reasonable care to prevent and detect violations is less than what is required of an employer with respect to protecting its own employees. So if you're the exposing employer, your burden is going to be slightly greater than the controlling employer, the employer that hired a subcontractor. So let's just go ahead and get into these four categories and define them, because it'll all make sense here once I get into it. Now, the creating employer is the employer that caused a hazardous condition that violates an OSHA standard. Employers must not create violative conditions, according to OSHA. An employer that does this is citable even if the only employees exposed are those of other contractors on the site. Did you get that? You can create a hazard and leave it, not even exposing your own employees to it, but you're exposing other contract employees at that same site or location. You could be cited. So here's an example. Let's say the employer host operates a manufacturing facility. It enters into a contract with one company to service machinery. The host employer fails to cover up some drums of a chemical despite the contractor's repeated requests that it do so. This could result in an airborne level of the chemical that exceeds the PEL that OSHA set, right? So let's say that's an example. The host is a creating employer because it caused the employees of the contractor to be exposed to contaminants above the PEL. Also, here, the next wrinkle here, the host employer failed to implement measures to prevent the accumulation of the air contaminant. It could have met its OSHA obligation by implementing the simple engineering control of covering up the drums. Having failed to implement a feasible engineering control to meet the PEL, the host is citable for the hazard. Here's another example to help drive the point. Let's say an employer, they're hoisting materials onto a floor, and they damage the perimeter guardrails. Neither its own employees nor employees of other companies are exposed to the hazard, and it takes effective steps to keep all employees, including those of the other employees, away from the unprotected edge and informs the controlling employer, the host, of the problem. So the company that was hoisting the materials onto, you know, up an upper level, the employer that damaged the guardrail, they lack authority to fix the guardrail themselves because it's not their site. So they would be considered the creating employer because it caused the hazardous condition by damaging the guardrails. But it lacked the authority to fix them, and it took immediate and effective steps to keep all other employees away from the hazard and notified the controlling employer of the hazard. So the company that created the hazard is not citable since it took effective measures to prevent employee exposure to the fall hazard. Does that make sense? Now let's talk about the exposing employer. This is an employer whose own employees are exposed to a hazard, regardless if you created it, right? If the exposing employer did create the violation, then it is citable for the violation as a creating employer. If the violation was created by another employer, the exposing employer is citable if it, one, knew of the hazardous condition or failed to exercise reasonable diligence to discover the condition, and two, failed to take steps consistent with its authority to protect its employees. If the exposing employer has authority to correct the hazard, it must do so. If the exposing employer lacks authority to correct the hazard, it is citable if it fails to do each of these following items. One, it must ask the creating and or controlling employer to correct the hazard. Two, it must inform its employees of the hazard. And three, it must take reasonable alternative protective measures. And in some extreme circumstances, like imminent danger situations, the exposing employer is citable for failing to remove its employees from the job altogether to avoid the hazard. Let's talk about an example. Let's say there's a contractor and they've been hired to inspect and clean a work area in a manufacturing plant around a large permanent hole at the end of each day. An OSHA standard requires guardrails, right, around that open hole. There are no guardrails around the hole, so the contractor, their employees, do not use personal fall protection, although it would be feasible to do so. So the contractor has no authority to install guardrails. However, it did ask the host, which operates the plants, to install them, and they refused. The subcontractor is an exposing employer because its employees are, in fact, exposed to the fall hazard. They didn't take steps to remove them from that hazard, so they allowed them to continue to work. It doesn't matter if you don't own the site and you can't put up guardrails. If you continue to allow your employees to work exposed to a hazardous condition, you could be cited. And in this case, as the exposing employer. So getting back to that example, the subcontractor we know has no authority to install the guardrails. It is required to comply with the OSHA requirements when feasible. It must take steps to protect its employees and ask the employer that controls the hazard to correct it. Although the subcontractor did ask for guardrails in this case, since the hazard was not corrected, the subcontractor was responsible for taking reasonable alternative protective steps like providing personal fall protection or just not allowing them to continue to work until the hazard was abated. Because it wasn't done, they're cited for the violation. That's a good example. One more. Let's say there's unprotected rebar on either side of an access ramp, and that presents an impalement hazard. So an electrical subcontractor does not have authority to cover the rebar. However, several times they asked the general contractor to cover the rebar. In the meantime, the subcontractor instructed its employees to use a different access route that avoided most of the uncovered rebar and required them to keep as far from the rebar as possible. Since the subcontractor employees were still exposed to some unprotected rebar, that subcontractor is an exposing employer. So, the subcontractor made a good faith effort to get the general contractor to correct the hazard and took some feasible measures within its control to protect its employees. So, they're not citable for the rebar hazard itself. They didn't create the hazard, but they are still allowing some of their employees to be exposed to the hazard. So, that's where you would get cited as an exposing employer. Now, the correcting employer, this is the third category you could fall into. The correcting employer is an employer who's engaged in a common undertaking on the same work site as the exposing employer and is responsible for correcting a hazard. This usually occurs where an employer is given the responsibility for installing and or maintaining particular safety and health equipment or devices. And the correcting employer must exercise reasonable care in preventing and discovering violations and meet its obligation of correcting the hazard. Let's get into an example of a correcting employer. Let's say a carpentry contractor is hired to erect and maintain guardrails throughout a large 15-story project, and work is proceeding on all of the floors with multiple contractors. The carpentry contractor, they inspect all floors in the morning and then again in the afternoon each day. It also inspects areas where materials delivered to the perimeter once the material vendor is finished delivering material to that area. You know, sometimes you got to remove a section of guardrail, get materials up to a deck or a floor, and then and put the guardrail back in place. So they would inspect after that activity is done as well. Other subcontractors are required to report damaged or missing guardrails to the general contractor, who then forwards those to the carpentry contractor. They then repair damaged guardrails immediately after finding them and immediately after they're reported. So on this project, very few instances of damaged guardrails have occurred other than where material has been delivered, temporarily removing those sections, as I noted. Shortly after the afternoon inspection on the sixth floor, workers moving equipment accidentally damage a guardrail in one area. No one tells the carpentry contractor of the damage, and they have not seen it yet. An OSHA inspection occurs at the beginning of the day prior to the morning inspection of the sixth floor. None of the carpentry's contractors' own employees are exposed to the hazard, but other employees are exposed. So the carpentry contractor is the correcting employer since it is responsible by contract for erecting and maintaining fall protection equipment. The steps they implemented to discover and correct the damaged guardrails, they were reasonable in light of the amount of activity and the size of the project. It exercised reasonable care in preventing and discovering violations, and in this example, would not be citable for the damaged guardrail since it could not reasonably have known of the violation. So this is where we start to get into some gray areas. It's really going to depend on the compliance officer and the size and scope of the work to determine whether or not it was reasonable for them to have known about the hazard prior to OSHA discovering it, and whether or not they had adequate time to respond and correct it. But the correcting employer in this case, this is where we get into contract language and the scope of contracts, the scope of work, to determine what in fact they're responsible for maintaining throughout the job. The controlling employer, the fourth category you could fall into under this multi-employer citation policy, is the controlling employer, an employer who has the general supervisory authority over the work that's being done. And this includes the power to correct safety and health violations itself or require others to correct them. Control can be established by either contract or, in the absence of explicit contractual provisions, by the exercise of control in practice. So descriptions and examples of different kinds of controlling employers, I'm going to get into here in a minute, but a controlling employer must exercise reasonable care to prevent and detect violations on the site, whether it's construction or general industry. the extent of the measures that a controlling employer must implement to satisfy this duty of reasonable care is less than what is required of an employer with respect to protecting its own employees. This means that the controlling employer is not normally required to inspect for hazards as frequently or to have the same level of knowledge of the applicable standards or of trade expertise as the employer it has hired. That is key. Let's say a manufacturing plant has a large boiler. They don't have certified folks that they hired and employ to work on these, but they have to hire a contractor to come in. They don't allow their employees to get inside the boiler to do repairs or certifications or anything. They don't mess with it, but they hire a contractor to come in and do it. They're supposed to be the experts. And let's say there's a confined space violation. The host employer has it adequately marked, has communicated the hazards to the contract employees when they arrived, but they're now on the hook, if you will, these contractors, because they're the experts in boilers and confined spaces and all of that good stuff. The host employer or controlling employer, they have less knowledge of that or expertise of that area of work. So that's why the burden could slightly be less on a controlling employer to inspect and correct those hazards. However, there are some gray areas here as well. Factors that affect how frequently and closely a controlling employer has to inspect to meet its standard of reasonable care include the following. One, the scale of the project, the size and scope. Another one, the nature and the pace of the work, including the frequency with which the number or types of hazards change as the work moves along. Another one, how much the controlling employer knows, both about the safety history and the safety practices of the employer it controls, and about that employer's level of expertise. Another item to consider, more frequent inspections are normally needed if the controlling employer knows that the other employer has a history of non-compliance, and this can change during the course of the work too. Greater inspection frequency may also be needed as a result of that. So if you've got a contractor coming out to do some work and after the first 4 or 5 days you notice that none of them are wearing their safety glasses and you have to get on them a couple of times, you're going to have to increase the frequency in which you check in or drop in on them as the controlling employer. So again, greater inspection frequency may be needed, especially at the beginning of the project if the controlling employer had never before worked with this employer and doesn't know its compliance history. So you're going to need to increase the frequency of oversight at the beginning of the project if you know nothing about this contractor. You've never worked with them before. Less frequent inspections may be appropriate where the controlling employer sees strong indications that the other employer has implemented effective safety and health efforts. Now, the most important indicator of an effective safety and health effort, of course, by other employers is consistently high level of compliance. In this case, appearances matter. You walk by or you go over to that area of the manufacturing floor or that area of the job, and you see everybody wearing their hard hats or everyone wearing their safety glasses. The harnesses are in place. Usually you can tell by just watching the way they work and seeing sort of, what they're wearing and the care they're taking, you can usually tell. So other indicators include the use of an effective or graduated system of enforcement for non-compliance with safety and health requirements, coupled with regular job site safety meetings and safety training or refresher training. So you could give them like a verbal warning. You could write them up. I've been on sites where they penalize you. It's in the contract, so you kind of agreed to it, but they'll issue a ticket, if you will, where you've got to pay by the end of the week, the company does, $150, and it goes to a local charity, stuff like that. I know many of us have seen job sites that are like that. In manufacturing, it's usually zero tolerance. Hey, you violate our fall protection, electrical lockout, tagout, or confined space entry, you're out, you're done. You're going to go, and we're going to get another contractor in here. So when evaluating whether a controlling employer has exercised reasonable care in preventing and discovering violations. Consider questions such as whether the controlling employer conducted periodic inspections of appropriate frequency, or whether the controlling employer implemented an effective system for promptly correcting hazards or having them corrected if they couldn't do so themselves, and whether the controlling employer enforces the other employer's compliance with safety and health requirements with an effective or graduated system of enforcement and follow-up inspections. Those three things: conduct periodic inspections and make sure the frequency is appropriate, implement effective systems for correcting hazards or having them corrected, and enforce the other employer's compliance with safety and health requirements, even documenting write-ups, verbals, or warnings, or kicking somebody, one particular worker off the site, stuff like that. Those three things. That is what is going to help the controlling employer get out of one of these categories of being able to be cited for the work others do. So control could be established by contract. This is important, right? In this case, the employer has a specific contract right to control safety. So you could hire a general contractor to oversee a project in which, by contract, that general contractor is the controlling employer. Now, to be a controlling employer, the employer must itself be able to prevent or correct a violation or require another employer to prevent or correct a violation. One source of this ability is explicit contract authority, language in the contract that is very clear. This can take the form of a specific contract right to require another employer to adhere to safety and health requirements and to correct violations that the controlling employer discovers. So, boilerplate language in the contract that says, subcontractor is responsible for maintaining the safety and health of its employees and employees in the affected areas of their work. They also must correct hazards that are brought to the attention of the subcontractor by another contractor or the general contractor. Stuff like that, right? You've seen standard language in contracts that cover all this stuff. Control can also be established by a combination of other contract rights, where there is no explicit contract provision granting the right to control safety, or where the contract says the employer does not have such a right, an employer may still be a controlling employer. The ability of an employer to control safety in this circumstance can result from a combination of contractual rights that, together, give it broad responsibility at the site involving almost all aspects of the job. Its responsibility is broad enough so that its contractual authority necessarily involves safety. It just kind of drags it in without explicitly calling it out. Does that make sense? So the authority to resolve disputes between subcontractors, the authority to set schedules and determine construction sequencing, those are particularly significant because they're likely to affect safety. If you can find that control in the contract, absent of explicit safety and health authority, then you can imply that you also control safety and health on this site or this project. I hope that makes sense. That one gets a little weird because, you know, you could have a contractor say, hey, it doesn't say anywhere in this contract that I'm responsible for overseeing safety of all these subcontractors. So you say, okay, so we're in the absence of that, what other control or authority does the contract give you, and is it, how broad is it? So basically, if you can hold subcontractors to a production schedule, you can penalize them for not meeting milestones. You have to inspect the quality of their work and force them to correct it if it doesn't meet some standard. All that stuff there would imply that you also have authority over the safety and health of those employers. So you would be a controlling employer. Finally, this is another one. A creating, correcting, or controlling employer will often also be an exposing employer. Consider whether the employer is an exposing employer before evaluating its status with respect to these other roles. But You know, exposing, creating, and controlling employers can be correcting employers as well if they are authorized to correct the hazard. So you can get into multiple roles. So you could have created the hazard. You're also responsible for correcting it. You could be a controlling employer. You could also be exposing, all of those could be exposing employers and could all be cited. So again, the exposing, creating, or controlling employer could also be the correcting employer. Let's say you're a subcontractor. You created a hole, and in contract, by contract, you're supposed to follow all applicable safety and health standards. You create this hole. You're supposed to fill the hole back in or cover it up. So you created it. You're also, by contract, the correcting employer. So that's an example. You created it. You could also be exposing your employees to it. But by contract, you're the correcting employer as well. So you can get into multiple roles, multiple ways you can get cited on a multi-employer worksite. Let's talk about, in general, bringing contractors or temporary employees onto your job site or into your facilities. Because contractors often perform, you know, specialized or even potentially hazardous tasks like confined space entries and, you know, non-routine repair activities, live electrical work, or, you know, something working at heights, any one of those things. Some safety procedures that contractors need to address with their employees before they go into the job include assuring that employees are trained in the work practices necessary to perform the job safely, including potential fire, explosion, or toxic release hazards. So you're going to want to request training documentation from these contractors before you bring them into your facility. And if you listen to, oh gosh, the OSHA outreach training episode that I did there, don't let a contractor produce an OSHA 10-hour or 30-hour card and say, yeah, we've had confined space, fall protection, and electrical safety. We sat through a 10-hour or we sat through a 30-hour. Those are voluntary outreach training programs and are not allowed to be used to satisfy other required training under the OSHA standard. You also have to assure that employees, contractor employees, know the applicable provisions of emergency action plans at your facility. You have to communicate that to the contractor. Get documented training. I can't stress this enough. If you do an orientation of your facility or your job site, document it. Make sure that you document that you've communicated emergency exits, emergency procedures, how to notify local authorities, or sound the alarm if there's an emergency, all of those things. Document, document, document that this took place. Also, inform the contractor, and the contractor has to inform their employees of the safety rules at the facility, particularly those implemented to control the hazards during operations in which they are involved. A good example of this is if you have a very specific lockout tagout procedure that you expect them to follow, you have to communicate and train them on it. Or you would have to turn around and train your employees that could be interacting with them if their lockout tagout procedures are different. They could be different and still meet the standard, but are different. The locks and tags look different, things like that. You have to go over that with your employees, or you have to go over your expectations with the contractor. They have to make sure they cover it with their employees. Also, you want to consider that, you know, if you require all contractors and subcontractors to abide by the same rules, you have to cover that. Contractors have to provide current workers' compensation insurance certificates and general liability coverage as well. So, you know, they're going to be expected to produce that. Also, contractors have to ensure that their employees comply with all applicable local, state, and federal safety requirements. You got that boilerplate language that you find in all contracts, right? As well as with any safety rules and regulations set by the company at which the work is being performed. They may go above and beyond minimum OSHA requirements. We run into this all the time. If you're a VPP company and you go above and beyond in many regards with confined space or fire protection, with a fire watch, stuff like that, they're used to minimum requirements. They're going to come in and be performing differently than what your employees are used to. It creates sort of, it's like oil and water, right? It creates this disruption in the facility. And I've dealt with this all the time that, you know, the host employees are coming to EHS or management saying, hey, look at this guy over here doing this job. They could be in compliance with minimum OSHA regs, but because the site has set standards much higher, their employees are used to those higher standards. When they see somebody not doing work up to those standards, it causes problems. So make sure you communicate the site rules that are expected to be followed. Also, it's always a good idea, contractors, I'm talking to you, okay? Discuss multi-employer roles and responsibilities regarding safety requirements with your foreman, with your supervisors, and with your employees. Make sure they understand, hey guys, safety is customer service. The way we do this job, like quality and ahead of schedule and under budget and all that good stuff, safety is customer service. It's protecting you, but it's protecting our customer. We're not going to expose our customer's employees to a hazard we create. We certainly aren't going to leave one behind. So it's a good idea. You know, customer service is a big deal, right? Safety is customer service. So make sure you address it from that angle. You'll probably get a lot more buy-in that way. Okay, Q&A round. I get a lot of questions about this as far as multi-employers go or contractors go. So let's answer some common questions that either you've been thinking about yourself, you've heard yourself, certainly I have heard. Let's talk about training. Who's required to provide safety training to temporary plant employees? And then what kind of training are they required to have? Now, a company would typically contact an agency or a temp agency to hire some workers, right? The temporary workers usually have a sort of a continuing relationship with that agency as they move from job to job, usually. Now, the agency is aware of the type of work that the temporary employee is performing and should also have a general idea of the types of hazards encountered in doing that work, right? The company who hires the temporary worker usually provides day-to-day job assignments and supervision and is aware of the worksite specific hazards that the temporary employee will be exposed to. In this case, there's going to be a shared responsibility between a temporary agency and the hiring employer to make sure that the temp workers receive adequate safety training. Now, the contract between the temp agency and the host employer should be used as a tool to clarify how required training will be provided. That is key. Any agency-supplied training, temp agency-supplied training, should be evaluated by the client, the hiring contractor, right, the host employer, to make sure that it's appropriate. That's one thing that's usually missing, by the way. Now, I would just a word of caution. I'm not an attorney. You should always speak to an attorney. However, from past experience, I know this to be the case, and I would continue to follow this even now. I would not, quote unquote, approve the training that the temp agency provided. I would simply object to the training as it, you know, maybe it was inadequate, or I would request more training be added, or I would accept it as adequate. So that's the thing. You don't want to get into, you know, whether or not you're rubber stamping or certifying training they'd received. However, you should reserve the right to object to training that wasn't adequate and suggest that they add this topic or that topic based on your site conditions, or agree to do an add-on training or site-specific training after their initial training through the temp agency. You bring them on board and do an orientation, which is always a good idea. So yeah, in that regard, the temporary agency would take responsibility for providing, you know, the basic safety training to the extent that it can, right, without knowing the site-specific hazards. And then the site would take on the site-specific hazards and do an orientation, where all the exits are, where the clinic is, where the first responders are, and, you know, all that good stuff. The client or hiring company, right, the manufacturing facility that's hiring the temp workers, should have a clear idea of the jobs that it will be, you know, that will be assigned to the temporary workers and identify all the hazards involved with them. So those hazards, right, those hazards will indicate the need for training. So there's your training needs assessment. So whenever I get a question of what kind of training should I be providing for these temp workers, the first question out of my mouth is, what are they going to be doing? Where are they going to be working? what tools and equipment, machinery, what environment, what chemicals. You know, you just go down that path and you're going to understand what type of training that you're going to need to cover with them. So yeah, the hazards will indicate the need for training. It's also going to tell you if you're going to need to do any monitoring or if it's going to trigger any medical surveillance like hearing, lead, stuff like that. So, you know, HAZCOM, emergency evacuation, lockout, tagout, PPE, maybe hearing protection. Maybe you get into process safety management if you're in a chemical or, you know, something, you know, petrochemical or even a chemical facility. You're going to get into some PSM stuff. That's going to drive a lot of training you're going to have set up, right? Portable fire extinguishers might be something you have to cover. And there may be situations where a short-term job will require specialized safety training that goes well beyond that of the temp agency of what they would normally provide. So here's an example, like repairing the inside of a process tank where the worker would need training and special training and equipment for confined space entry, you know, respiratory protection, a physical pulmonary function test, cover and lockout, tag out, welding safety and fire prevention, all that good stuff. In that case, you know, the host employer, the hiring company would need to either get with the temp agency if that's going to be ongoing type of work and set something up, or they would have to train that temp worker themselves to be able to do that job safely. Another good question is, I get contractor safety. I understand sort of the contract and what we do and what the temp agency does or the contractor does, but how can we improve contractor safety at my site? Well, one, good communication. Always, you know, treating your contract employees like your own. Okay, that as far as communication, you know, touching base with them, going out to the shop floor, around the project site, and talking with them, and checking up on them and seeing how they're doing. Good communication and visibility is key. The effectiveness of a subcontractor or a contractor safety program, that depends upon, you know, obviously the active support and involvement of all employees of every contractor at the site. And as the host employer, you're ultimately responsible for the safety and health of the contractors that are working at your site, at least looking after them and making sure you point things out to the correcting employer, for example, if that's not you. But you're the controlling employer, you're the host employer. So hands-on, high visibility, good communication is the first thing I would recommend. Also, before any contract work begins, designate a representative to coordinate and communicate safety and health issues with the contractor. So pick somebody on your team that will be the point person for that contractor. Advise the contractor that the facility safety and health policies have to be followed. Provide the contractor with a copy of your safety plan. Also, it's always a good idea, inform the contractor of any emergency signals and procedures. What does the alarm sound like? What to do when they hear that alarm? That includes telephone numbers of the nearest hospital, ambulance service, or fire department, things of that nature. If they're an out-of-state, and this happens a lot, you're in Nebraska and you hire a company to work on your robot in your plant, and that contract employee is from Oklahoma. They're not going to be familiar with the local area. They're not going to know where the local urgent care is or emergency room, things like that. So it's always a good idea to provide sort of an overview of the geography where they're going to be working. You can also thoroughly communicate any safety and health hazards with the contractor's designated rep, especially HAZCOM issues and hazards that aren't obvious. It's the contractor's responsibility to convey this information to their employees. Make sure that you're communicating with them up front. Another big one that gets missed. Do a pre-startup meeting or a walkthrough with the contractor's rep, right? And maybe their supervisor from the areas of the plant involved in the contractor's work. So go take them, like, here's where you're going to park. Every day when you come in, you're going to park here. You're going to come through this gate. You're going to come through this door. And when you unload your trucks, it's going to be at this dock, and you're going to use a forklift, or you're going to use your job box and push it through this aisle into your work area. Do the dry run ahead of time. it really helps the subcontractor get this mental picture of how the work is going to unfold day to day, especially in different stages when you're going to bring different types of equipment on the job, especially if more building materials are going to be brought on in different phases, or in the case of demolition, you know, how we're going to remove stuff out, where the roll-off is going to be located, stuff like that. What, do a walkthrough, a dry run, so they have an idea of what to expect when they get there. Review all contract requirements related to safety and health with the contractor's designated rep. This includes, but is not necessarily limited to, rules, procedures, PPE, any special work permits that your site requires. I've been on sites, they require a ladder permit. I was on a site once, they had some contractors doing stuff on the roof. They required a roof permit. And yeah, it's exactly what it sounds like. Just like a confined space permit, they wanted to know who was going up on the roof, write their names down, how long the work was going to take place or expected to take place, what equipment you're taking up with you, where are you going to place the ladder, all that good stuff they wanted to know. And then when you came down, you had to terminate that permit, indicating that you've removed all the items from the roof in the work area, all the employees have come down, and then boom, you're done, you're off the roof. So you have to communicate with them some of this stuff. Review the preparation of the worksite before the contractor begins initial work. You're going to want to go and do a walkthrough before they show up to make sure you document the condition of any facilities, walls, beams, floors, equipment that's near in the area they're going to be working. Because if there's any damage that occurs after that, you want to make sure you had that prior check, photograph, or video. And ensure that all employees at your company have received training on the hazards to which they may be exposed to during the course of the contract work. Dust, some smells or odors, like explain they're going to be doing some painting, but it's water-based paint, low VOC, it's not lead-based, but you may smell this, so don't be alarmed. Or they're going to be cutting, they're going to be using a torch or some cutting tools, and you may smell something that you're not used to smelling. So always make sure you communicate to your internal employees the nature of the work that the contractors are going to engage in. Look, tying it all together is just about that. It's about communication. Setting expectations up front with a temp agency, here's what we expect the workers to do. With the temp workers, here's what we expect you to do. With your employees, here's what we expect you to do with regards to the contract workers. Here are our site policies. Here are our rules. What rules do you have? What requests do you have of us as the host employer? And make sure you're open and communicate all that ahead of time up front. And together, you guys can all improve safety. The host employer, controlling employer, and the other categories of employers under this multi-employer worksite citation policy OSHA has, together, communicating together and collaborating together, that's how you're going to manage all of this. And you're not going to find yourself in a position of trying to point a finger of saying, hey, well, we're just a subcontractor. That pit was there before us. And then the controlling employer saying, yeah, but you know, we pointed that out to you when you got here, and that's why you're here. We hired you to help renovate and then cover that pit up. You know, you don't get into this battle when you're upfront, open about everything, and you do the work ahead of time before the work begins. You kind of go through those processes. So, hey, look, I wanted to cover this topic. You know, it's a big deal. A lot of folks ask me still to this day, you know, how to deal with contractors when they come onto their sites, and it can be tough. But remember those four categories, and whether or not you fit into any of those four categories, whether or not your subcontractor fits into any of those four categories of employers, and what's your contract look like? Do we have strong language in the contract? Some of it's negotiable, but make sure you understand that. Make sure when you send an engineer to oversee the work, or you send a safety rep out to do an inspection, make sure they understand which contractor's responsible for correcting things and which aren't. Make sure that they're equipped with this knowledge as well when they go out and oversee some of this work. That's where I'm going to leave it. I would like to hear your feedback. I want to see your emails. If you have any comments on this, please shoot them over to me. The email link is in the show notes. Also, don't forget, go ahead and visit MightyLineTape.com/podcast. Get a free sample of MightyLine floor tape. It's pretty good stuff, folks. I'm telling you, check them out. You can also catch past episodes of the podcast right there on their blog page. If you're a new listener, thanks. We appreciate you tuning in. Go ahead and check some past episodes out as well. Hit that subscribe button. That's the easiest way for you to make sure you don't miss an episode. You can automatically download past episodes as well. And if you think of it, leave a rank and review. Let me know how I can improve the podcast. Another one is a listener request. I get these all the time. And more, all of my topics seem to be driven by the listeners, which is good. That's how I knew we were onto something here with the podcast when, you know, we started getting topics driven by the listeners. And that's easy. It's easy for me because I just simply have to read your emails and your requests, and then I can respond to them. And it's sort of like two-way communication, right? So keep those emails coming. Let us know what we can do to improve the podcast. And stay tuned for the next episode. But of course, like always, until then, be safe.